Welcome to Awake, the Sleep Health Podcast. In a world that often underestimates the importance of sleep, we are here to shed light on the vital role it plays in your well-being. Join us on a journey to explore what is sleep health and the science of sleep. Together, we will better understand what happens when we sleep. We will tackle sleep apnea and other sleep disorders. We will address the significant sleep disparities and what to do to minimize them. With you, we will discover cutting-edge sleep technologies and unlock the secrets to achieving better sleep. Get ready to not only be awake, but also to experience the transformative power of quality sleep and good sleep health. Hi, Devin. We have known each other for a long time. You're Devin McGraw, and you're one of the people, or maybe the person with the biggest and longest expertise in patient data and patient privacy that I've met. You've done so many things that I cannot even tell our audience what you've done. So I'm just going to ask you to tell us the main points of your career.
Gilles, it's very good to see you, and thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Probably about 15 to 20 years ago, I started to focus on health data. I had been a healthcare lawyer for a number of years, but saw pretty quickly that data was pretty critical to improving our healthcare system, to empowering individuals and patients to be more in control of their health, to be able to share with caregivers. Data is a critical piece of all of that. And so I started to think about how do we get data moving in healthcare? How do we make data more accessible to patients? And privacy was always talked about as, oh, we have to solve for privacy. I didn't really know very much about privacy, to be honest. I had been a lawyer, but I had not studied HIPAA. And I became a HIPAA lawyer, essentially, and had a number of different types of positions in sort of dealing with health data, from working in nonprofit organizations to both evangelize the need for health data to be collected and shared, but also to think about what protections need to be put into place. And then I did a stint in the federal government where I was the deputy director for health information privacy, all things HIPAA at the HHS Office for Civil Rights, and the acting chief privacy officer at the HHS Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. So within the Department of Health and Human Services in the US, those are two very key offices that facilitate both privacy and exchange of data. And I have also worked to advise companies on how to comply with data. And presently I am at Invitae, which is a genetic testing company that acquired a startup that I helped co-found called Citizen, which helps patients gather all their health information so that they're in control of their data and can use it and share it as they see fit. I think I hit the high points.
I think that probably will explain why we invited you, since we have a couple of questions about systems and data interoperability, which is really a huge problem. Many people know that if they move from one hospital to another, getting data from one to the other is very complicated. You have been involved in this for, as you said, probably 15 years now.
Yeah, maybe more. I lose count. The years are going very fast. Things progress slowly. Years go fast.
We both have been paying attention to this electronic health record and like how incredibly complicated it is to get data, how incredibly complicated it is for patients to really have full access to the data that is in one of those systems. And if they change insurance companies or hospital, then it becomes really much more complicated. Can you tell us where we are today? And as a follow-up, have you seen real progress happen about this over the last 15 years?
I think in general, we have made some progress, but we've been at this for quite a bit of time, and we haven't made so much progress that for many patients, they see the difference yet. I'll give you a couple of examples. So I recently had an encounter in the healthcare system, and I was pleasantly surprised when they entered my name and pulled up every single one of the last medications that I had been prescribed from a prior visit. I was no longer taking most of them, but this was from an occurrence. I fell off my bike and broke my collarbone. So many medications were prescribed they were asking me, oh, are you still on this? Are you still on this? So they knew that. And these are, you know, was in two very different locations. And so I was pleased when that happened. And I was somewhat surprised because that was something that probably a few years ago would not have been the case. Now, did I happen to be in a well-connected system? I was actually in a rural, somewhat rural destination, or a destination that is rural out of season. I was out of season. Anyway, so there's been some progress there. Also, for patients to get their information, it used to be the case that not even too long ago, you had to go to the basement of the hospital and during office hours and hope that you didn't show up during the lunch hour, and then potentially in person be able to get your records, maybe, or you might have had to come back or have them mailed to you or something, some very kludgy process. And now I think most of us are accustomed to at least having a view into our health information on a portal. It's sometimes not easily portable. It's not always easy to, let's say you have your own tool that you use to gather your health information, to make that connection so that there's a download of your data. So all the places where you've been seen are all in one place. That is still a bit challenging. You have to remember your username and password in every place where you've been seen, and you might have to enter it several times in order for that connection to remain. And in addition, all you get is the information in the electronic health record. It doesn't necessarily include information that might have been collected in a different system and wasn't necessarily in the EMR. That's a lot of data. We work with a lot of cancer patients. It's frequently that pathology reports are not included and images of their tumors not included. It's only been recently that notes, which have all the details on your chemotherapy regimens, were part of that. So just, that's just by way of example. And then, of course, if you're dealing with an illness where there's a significant amount of self-collected data, right? Let's say you have a sleep disorder and you use an app to monitor the quality of your sleep. There's no way that's likely to be in your medical record unless you're seeing a medical provider who's very forward-thinking and has asked for you to provide that data to them. And even when that's the case, the process of getting that data into them is not very easy. Depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, that's either a glass half full or a glass half empty or a glass a quarter full. It is better than it was. We have so far to go, and it still feels like it's harder than it should be to be reaching some of those important milestones.
This is a podcast about sleep and sleep disorders and sleep health. So I'm particularly focused on sleep apnea, because sleep apnea touches the life of between 20 and 50 million Americans. No one really knows how many. 90% of them don't even, 80% or 90% don't even know they have it. But what we know is that if you have sleep apnea, it's almost certainly associated with some comorbidities, and nothing about sleep because you're sleeping. The only way anyone can know something about sleep, which is a completely invisible part of your life, is through data collected through either a CPAP machine if you have been diagnosed and being treated, or through some app or wearable. And how, what are we going to do to make sure that all of this data is collected in one way so that people can have a real view of what's happening in the, during their sleep, and what are the consequences if their sleep is disordered or not happening in the proper way?
I suspect that for sleep disorders, as well as other disorders where there's a substantial amount of data gathering that is going to be enormously helpful, that it takes place in the home or as part of an activity of daily living, that the interoperability that we seek with having home data integrated with clinician data is not at all happening in most cases. We have been working so hard to focus on just getting the data collected in the clinical setting out of that, out of one clinical setting and into other clinical settings and to the patient. But when you mentioned the notion of patient-generated data coming back into the record and integrating, it still feels like a very foreign concept. Suddenly, medical organizations who for years have depended on their patients to let them know verbally what's going on in their lives don't want to get any of this automated data sent to them. I mean, many of them do. I don't want to cast aspersions on the entire medical community, but at least at the level of policy setting, there's the push for incoming data from the patient side is coming from the patients without a whole heck of a lot of support from the medical or electronic medical record vendor community. There's lots and lots of companies out there that serve patients with home gathering types of devices, whether it's a wearable or something on your watch, which is how I've been keeping track of my sleep lately. The clinicians, a lot of times don't want it. I hope that's not true for sleep professionals who, of course, appreciate the need for this data, but they're working in systems. They're in major hospital systems that all buy the sort of standard EMR products that are out there that are not necessarily well equipped for easy integration of data from home devices. On the other side, you also, as a patient, you want to have easy access to clinical data so that you can be doing, to the extent that you want to do a little of your own integration of that data and try to figure out if your sleep is off beyond what you're accustomed to, are there things going on clinically that you're noticing that might be helpful for you as well as your medical providers to sort of try to put two and two together, much less the ability to research all of this, to understand more,
of course,
in the sleep disorder context about the link between comorbidities, about the links between other environmental factors and things of that nature. We're so far behind that I can imagine that it feels incredibly frustrating. And we haven't made any progress at all for populations of people with sleep disorders.
I help build and manage a very large system of online communities for cancer patients that happened right at the time where oncology was going through a major transformation. And I saw when we started in 95, oncology was still amazingly paternalistic. When I stopped working with cancer patients 25 years later, it was almost impossible to think that at the big yearly meeting of FASCO, the Oncology Society, it was almost impossible to think that the big panels would not have patient representation. Because in oncology, everybody understands the voice of the patient is fundamental to advance science, knowledge, and treatment. Sleep medicine is the most paternalistic subspecialty of medicine that I've ever seen. Patients, in general, are never taught that they should know what's happening in their sleep. Even the vast majority of people that have a CPAP machine don't even know that this machine is collecting all a bunch of data that they can have access to. That data is usually sent through a cell modem to their providers, which receive some of that data, but not always all of it. The SD card that are in the machine do collect a huge amount of data, but no one tells the patient that you have an open source software that can allow you to have a visual representation of it. And that if you do this and end up connecting that data from the CPAP machine together with the data from wearables, you can then have a much bigger vision of what's happening in your life. And since sleep is so fundamental for your general health, I think it's very important for people to start to understand that you need to analyze what's happening in your sleep if you want to maximize how long you're going to live, basically, and do some changes if you see that something is not working. But there is nothing in the systems today that allow a normal person to do this. I mean, you really have to dig very deep in order to learn about this open source software, which is not trivial to use. I wonder what we should do to change that situation, or can we change it?
I do think absolutely it can be changed. It doesn't mean
you did it with Citizen, right?
It can be changed, but it is not, it's a shame to hear that there is such a strong paternalism tendency in the sleep, among the sleep clinicians, because that's so unfortunate and it makes no sense to me given how much of sleep is impacted by home factors, things that are completely outside the clinic setting. I mean, it's one thing to go into a sleep study and have to sort of sleep there and collect data, but most of the time you're not sleeping there, you're trying to sleep at home. And that's where so much of our health is generated generally. And then in sleep, even more so, it makes no sense to me. Having some clinician champions is always helpful, because I think you would agree that it helped in oncology. The patients really drove it, but having some forward-thinking clinicians who recognize the importance of this for the health of their patients, as well as the advancement of cancer medicine, was pretty key. So having some champions will help. I think also, if we have had a lot of difficulty in the patient access to data movement, with patients being able to access data from medical devices that are not, you know, things that the patient buys off the shelf, like my watch, But it is something that is almost, and maybe in the case of a CPAP, a prescribed device, which is intended to communicate data to clinicians. It's actually heartening to hear that there is an open source way to access this data, because certainly in the pacemaker setting, for example, the manufacturers of those devices, for the most part, have dug in their heels. No, the patient doesn't have a right to this data. It doesn't belong to them. And yet it's coming out of your body and you can feel it. And it is certainly having access to that data could be quite critical to your health and your own management, self-management of cardiac. So I just don't understand, you know, we have had difficulty in that setting. So if the door has been opened, I think it's worth exploring with the major manufacturers of these devices, how to make that easier. And certainly having some clinician champions can help. And then fighting from a policy context to crowbar it out with the law, clarification around this is data that is used to make decisions about patients that comes out of a patient. At a minimum, they should have a right to get a copy of that. And all of those pieces may need to be pushed on at different levels.
Sure. And we really should work to create more software that makes it more easily, more friendly for an average person to just have access to that data and see what it is. Absolutely. This issue of sleep apnea and comorbidity is so important to me. I don't know if you're aware, but the majority of people that have atrial fibrillation, for example, also have sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. And if they have sleep apnea and it's not treated, their chance of getting a stroke from that atrial fibrillation is multiplied by a factor of 5 to 6. And so it should be really an issue of public health that if you have atrial fibrillation, your general practitioner and your cardiologist should ask a couple of questions about how you sleep. The fact is that I've asked many patients and most of them are never asked a single question. I mean, I think it's in this kind of like huge problems, it's easier to change the mindset of patients than it is to change the mindset of healthcare professionals. But in order to change the mindset of patients, you need to be able to give them access to the data so they understand what their problem is. And so I don't know
how we're going to do this. No disagreement here. Yeah.
Maybe we should look into doing something like Citizen for sleep disorders.
I have found, now we're a small company and the most amount of time that it takes for us is on the data curation side. For all of the patients on the Citizen platform, we get thousands of pages of data. And that raw data is, of course, very important, but is undigestible by the patient, by the clinician in a short period of time, or by researchers. So there's a lot of work that goes into the data curation element. What are the most important aspects of that so that the data is then sort of ready to be utilized in self-care, in clinical care, and in research? But this is something that you all are expert in. And so the idea that you can kind of create a way for patients to have a platform where they can easily see their data, where they can broker a clinician to see that data, and then they can allow that data at their discretion to be utilized for research is an absolutely fantastic idea. And is the model that we have tried to operate as well as some of the other peer platforms in this space, because it really is the push for this is coming from the patients in most of these cases, not from the clinicians, but the forward thinking clinicians see the value and can be huge champions.
When it comes to oncology, most of the innovation came from the communities of people with unusual types of cancer. It didn't come from breast cancer or prostate cancer, the two big monsters. It came from people that had like weird, like unusual mutations or really rare cancers.
Yeah.
Because of the absolute needs, since there were very few specialists able to help them, those communities basically became communities of micro experts and were able to like really find ways to bring up the level of science pretty fast.
Absolutely. And I know this because you were part of the very early movement of this, but it is growing. There was a great study that was done out of IQVIA, which is a clinical research organization, on just how many patient registries there are and how many of them are now directly involved in facilitating.
Pretty obvious to me that this is exactly the kind of things that we need to do about sleep disorders in general.
I agree.
And sleep health. Sleep health is fundamental. I mean, it's really one of the three main pillars of health.
And it may be even the most important one, because you cannot survive a few days without sleep. Yeah. You can survive without food, but you cannot survive without sleep. My last question to you is, do you have one story of great success in what you have done?
Three that come to mind. So now I'm going to have to choose. I think I'll choose cancer example. So we work with the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation. So this is bile duct cancer, which is a rare cancer for which there are not good standard of care therapies and the prognosis is poor. Finding a clinical trial, even as a first line of therapy, is often highly desired by these patients. But anybody who's tried to search for a trial on clinicaltrials.gov knows how hard that is. And you will always need your medical records in order to determine if you're even eligible to be considered for a trial, much less getting to the enrollment stage. And typically patients don't have that degree of depth of data. And it's also not always formulated in clinical trial language.
Yes.
We have our patients on our platform with cholangiocarcinoma have all their medical records. We work to develop a tool that would give them a clinical trial match report. Green, yellow, red, right? Based on the criteria in clinicaltrials.gov, you match 100% with the inclusion and exclusion criteria to these trials. Yellow is, oh, actually, you're pretty close. And maybe with an additional test or some improvements in a certain score, you might be eligible. And then red is, no, you're not going to be eligible for them. And then we organize them by geography. Here's one that's 45 minutes from your home. Here's one that's close to your children. You can enter the zip codes of places where you want to search. We matched a patient to a clinical trial and she went into the study and was doing extraordinarily well on the therapy. Her doctor did not know about that trial. She found that trial. We helped her find that trial without her having to manually search for it. So these are stories that I think I know you're familiar with in cancer, of patients sort of finding their own way, but to make it easy for them and give them something that is not just a rough search of all the cholangiocarcinoma trials in a certain geography, but one that is very fine grained. Like, you look like a map for this trial if you contact those trial sponsors to see if there are additional criteria, proprietary criteria that might not be published, or to do some additional screening. There might be something here for you. And there was. And she got in that trial. So it just shows letting the patient help and giving them the tools and the power to do that can have incredible results. And not just for individuals, but for populations of people in terms of building patient registries that facilitate greater research. You're familiar with lots of those that are out there and doing very good work. And the patient organizations are the key. Hard to do this by yourself as an individual.
It's impossible. I can say without hesitation that all the young oncologists that join our communities or are new about those communities early on, all those physician scientists that were involved in early phase clinical trials have done extraordinarily well in their career because it's not by chance that they were the early pioneers that figured out that those communities were valuable. They are great doctors. Great physician scientists do share exceptional intellect and exceptional humility, and they've done amazingly well for themselves as well, amazingly well for their patients. And the interaction between those doctors and the patient communities have saved the lives of tens of thousands of people. It's quite simple. So it's something we need to redo the same for sleep disorders.
I agree. I have loved ones with sleep disorders.
I suffer from severe sleep apnea. And I have to say that after I started treating my sleep apnea with the CPAP machine, I'm 10 times more effective than I was before. I used to fall asleep every day between 2 and 3. That's it. My brain was not functioning. And within 3 seconds, I would fall asleep at my desk. It never happens again. I have very long days of work and without an interruption.
Well, I'm glad to
hear
that.
Anyway, thank you very much for your time. It was a real pleasure to have you on. And
thank you. Look forward to continuing to talk about all of this.
Thank you for tuning in to Awake, a sleep health podcast. Your journey to better sleep starts here. For detailed show notes, resources mentioned in today's episode, and additional ways to enhance your sleep quality and sleep health, be sure to check out sleephealth.org. This podcast is presented by the American Sleep Apnea Association, a national nonprofit organization dedicated to raise public awareness of the fundamental importance of quality sleep and to improve the lives of sleep apnea patients through education, services, peer support, research, and advocacy. Until next time, sweet dreams and rest well.